The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back in 1989, the rapper Chuck D called rap music Black America's TV station. Especially in its early days, hip-hop artists boldly critiqued political and economic oppression, along with their unabashed proclamations of wealth and bravado. Billionaire and reality TV star Donald Trump became a symbol of the latter. Hip-hop artists dropped his name in songs and praised his wealth, luxury, and power.
Next time you see me, I have money like Donald Trump. I'm off the easy. It could be night, day. I'm still creeping.
Now his name is coming up again.
I'm about to turn Black Panther. Don't let Donald Trump win that cancer. He's too rich. He ain't got the answers. He can't make decisions.
Allison McCann is a visual journalist for 538, and she wanted to get a read on how all the major candidates were represented in hip-hop songs, especially whether hip-hop lyrics reflected Trump's shift from high-rolling businessman to politician, famous for controversial statements on race, immigration, and Muslims. Allison McCann, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So why hip-hop lyrics as an indicator?
I think you kind of hinted at it, too, that I think hip hop is sort of unique in it, in its criticisms of not just politicians, but, you know, celebrities and other types of people in positions of power. To me, it's a unique genre of music in that it is very, you know, quick to criticize and quick to sort of weigh in on topics that are going around in ways that I don't think other genres of music do.
We use the lyrics annotation site Genius to find references to Trump and to Hillary Clinton from the database of songs. How many of them mention Trump?
I believe it was 266 songs dating back to 1989 was the earliest one that I found.
Well, let's hear a clip from Lies by the Fat Boys in 1989.
Boy, I got money like Donald Trump.
Yeah, right.
Your body 0 for 100, homeboy, you're in a slump.
So they're taking down someone for boasting about their wealth, like Donald Trump. So is that mainly the Trump characterization we get in hip hop?
Absolutely. That's been, you know, the Trump characterization, I guess, up until last year. The number of references to his wealth was just over 100. And to the Trump Tower brand, I think, was 68 songs. And that's, you know, put that in context, someone like Clinton has only had about 20 political references in the course of her, you know, political lifetime. So you can tell that Trump is far greater in his wealth and Trump Tower.
Yeah, it's like oftentimes they're saying, like, we're hanging out with Trump and Trump Towers.
Yeah, I think Trump Tower just became a shorthand for like being a very cool place to be, or even when it wasn't. Like, it's funny to me that it's still like in the last year or two, there are Trump Tower references. And I'm like, is that still like the best hotel chain in hip hop? But who knows?
Well, let's dig into that in a minute. But I'm wondering about Hillary Clinton, who's been in the public eye since the early days of hip hop. Is she references specifically back then, or is it Bill Clinton, the president?
So we removed any references that were explicitly about Bill because we did want to focus just on Hillary, but we kept sort of broadly the Clinton family, you know, anti-Clinton as this sort of group. So yeah, they also had their sort of own long history of hip hop. They had been mentioned in, I think it was 92 songs back to 1993. And that includes, yeah, Hillary and Clinton family, but not just Bill.
Well, here's a clip from Ludacris's Let's Stay Together.
If Will and Jada can do it, then why can't we? Hillary's still with Bill Clinton. How do they do it? He got his sucked and the whole damn world knew it. Now Paul McCartney's losing half of his life.
So not an altogether positive portrayal of Hillary Clinton. We know that women haven't always done well in hip hop. Do you think that's indicative in the mentions of Hillary Clinton in the songs that you looked at?
Yeah, we you know, tried to loosely classify all the songs as either positive, negative, or neutral to the best of our ability. And about a third of all references to Hillary and the Clinton family were negative, compared to, I think, you know, less than a quarter of Trump's. So she definitely has fared worse in hip hop, I think, being a woman and being, you know, associated with Bill during his presidency. But it is starting to change a little bit, I think, in the past year or two. I found a couple references that were a little, you know, more excited about the possibility of a female president. I think Little B, the bass god, was one of those.
So when did references to Trump begin to change in hip hop lyrics, from the kind of, you know, hanging out with him at the Trump Towers to a less positive look?
So that turned for us, I guess we saw that happening right around the start of 2015. Before that year, he'd only received 8 negative references in total. But over the last year and a half, that number has, I think, more than quadrupled, and it's up to about 34 negative references. So the turn has been swift and big, we've only seen in, I guess, you know, 16 months of Trump's, you know, sort of foray into politics. And we're already seeing that hip hop is, you know, sort of quick to change their tune.
We're talking with Allison McCann, a visual journalist for 538. She and her colleagues surveyed lyrics of hip hop songs, searching for mentions of candidates Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton to see how they respectively have been and are being portrayed. The name of her article tells us a little bit about the findings. Hip hop is turning on Trump. Are there any specific lyrics critiquing or referencing Trump policy, or maybe rather than policy, I should say statements?
I think the FDT clip that you played is the most explicit, and it's, you know, sort of saying, I'm surprised the Nation of Islam hasn't killed you. He references a lot about his, you know, YG is very close with the Hispanic population in Southern California. So he talks a lot about, you know, sort of, if you come at, you know, Hispanics, then well, I'm going to come back at you too. So yeah, I think YG's song is definitely the most critical of the things that Trump has been saying.
I also was looking through for negative references for Trump on your infographics. Chris Webby says, you'll never see it like Donald Trump on a prayer mat. And this is from T.I.'s remix of the Anderson .Paak track Come Down from 2016.
I fantasize shooting Trump down. A shot for every black man who got gunned down. By the police with no conviction, so they run round. When we protest, they tell us pipe down for Trayvon and Mike Brown. CNN wanna make it black white, cause we hit the action with a black light. Man,
so what did you hear there from T.I.? Very specific kind of dig at Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. That one was a really good example of sort of this pointed, you know, reference to black protesters at his events and being kicked out. And I think that's just pretty incredible to have sort of hip hop responding to events that are happening, you know, a month or 2 months ago. To me is what makes hip hop so interesting.
Well, there has been a critique of rap that political content has withered somewhat since the days, you know, when NWA and Public Enemy were attacking white racism, you know, Fight the Power, as it's become more commodified and corporatized is the criticism. What did you observe? Did you see any real shift there?
Yeah, I guess that's sort of what I was talking about before a little. And I actually spoke with Migos. They're a group from Atlanta who had, I think they had 6 mentions to Trump and often were very positive in them. And I kind of asked, you know, what does Trump represent in your music? And they were, you know, very like, he's a useful shorthand. He's, you know, the things that we want to represent of being rich and worthy. But at the same time, they were very quick to say, we don't support his politics. You know, we do not think he should be president. And, you know, now we are going to, they were saying, you know, they were working on an upcoming song and they would reference him politically. And I kind of asked, well, isn't that a little bit hypocritical? And they were, you know, like, no, it's very easy for us to separate, you know, these two things. So I do think it is super interesting to have this commodified Trump to exist at the same time with political Trump, and hip hop is complicated like that, I guess.
Allison McCann, a visual journalist for 538. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now you'll find a link to read her article, Hip Hop is Turning on Donald Trump. The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Anybody can sound off on the internet. It is much harder to share your opinions or talk about what's plaguing you in person. For artist, actor, filmmaker, and radio producer Sukhyun Lee, that real-life discourse is the stuff of a sleepover.
I invite 3 strangers to share a hotel room with me for one night. Each stranger arrives with a specific problem they need help with. And then over the next 24 hours, we hash it out and get to know one another while stuck in one room.
Sleepover is a CBC radio show and podcast that invites listeners into the unrehearsed and unpredictable encounters that can only happen when strangers are thrown together face-to-face in a limited space for a limited time. Our guest is host and orchestrator of The Sleepover, Sukyun Lee. Sukyun, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be here, Virginia.
So this is one of those, this is crazy, this is brilliant. ideas. There are so many ways to put people together to talk. Why a sleepover?
Well, there's kind of affectionate feeling, you know, like every kid, I had sleepovers when I was a kid and very fond of those memories of dragging a sleeping bag out. And, you know, I'm a big fan of pillow talk. I really love that. I could do that forever. And that notion of, you know, bringing in very diverse and different people in to share a space. I mean, I think that sort of begins in a kind of open and friendly place. And then we get to the tough stuff.
Are there any rules in this container of a hotel room? I mean, can people come and go? Are there any ways, like language you shouldn't use? Any shoulds or shouldn'ts?
Well, generally speaking, you know, there's an agreement. No one's being forced into this situation. Everyone has been approached. I've, you know, found very amazing and intriguing people that I know kind of are very different from one another. I want to see how they're going to collide and clash with one another. There's an essential agreement to share space and create space. So there's a kind of like understanding that what we create together. Other than that, I haven't encountered anyone having to, you know, run out of the hotel yet or take a smoke break, thank goodness. But we essentially create this very intense 24-hour experience, a kind of leap of faith to be together and create conversation and connection.
There have been three episodes at the time that we're speaking to you based on one encounter, 24 hours. There are these three distinct half-hour episodes based on each of the three strangers. Here's just a clip of you introducing them.
First of all, I want to thank you for taking a giant leap of faith with me. Over the next 20 hours or so, we're going to be asking each other all kinds of nosy questions. Are you ready?
Yes.
As ready as I can be.
What is nosy?
That last one adorably asking what nosy means is Charlie McGettigan. She's 8 years old. We also heard from Sachi Cole. She's a social media maven, writes for BuzzFeed Canada. And Alan Zweig. Am I saying that right?
Alan Zweig.
Zweig. He's 64. He warns them all he snores rather loudly. All three have to have a problem to be solved and be willing to submit to this 24-hour experiment. How are they chosen?
Well, you know, in very many different ways. So say, for example, Charlie, I know from my neighborhood, she's an extremely dynamic and precocious 8-year-old girl. Her mom's a Romanian dancer. Her dad's a Newfoundland rocker. Charlie is her unique own being and lots of energy and intelligence. Love her so much. I also wanted to include a range of people, ages, careers, viewpoints, beliefs, religions, right across, because I find that many times, you know, in this day and age, we kind of are so separated and oftentimes communicate virtually. So, or technology mediates our correspondence. So really trying to put individuals together who would never find themselves in a room together in the first place. So she was on the list, and then trying to figure out who would kind of tangentially be interesting to sort of collide with her. And Alan Zweig, as you say, he's a senior citizen. He's also a documentary filmmaker. Alan is a curmudgeon. He's a big grumpy pants. I mean, I saw him through my Facebook feed. I was like, who is this guy? He's so grumpy. He's always so kind of complaining about stuff, but in a kind of like those two guys that would be in the balcony on the Muppet Show, those guys. So I was like, okay, I got to get a grouch, Mr. Grouchy in there. Alan's interesting too, because, you know, most of his life he's felt like a big loser. And it's only recently that his career has taken off, that he actually found a woman who fell in love with him and together they had a child. So he calls himself an old dad. He's a senior, but his daughter, she's like 5 years old. So, you know, he has complications where he picks up his daughter from school and he can feel all the other kids looking at her saying, who's the old guy with the big belly picking her up? So he's very upfront about these things. You know, I think a big part of it is finding people who, A, have difficulties in their lives, which is everyone, but also people willing to speak of them candidly. And then there was Sachi Cole, who is a very interesting and opinionated woman. She's a writer and also a big online presence through social media. She's very politically minded, and she often calls out what she feels is injustices, specifically to do with privilege and race and socioeconomic injustices. And she's, you know, I wanted to see what she would be like with Alan in that same room, because in a lot of ways, on paper, you would think that they would have very oppositional perspectives. And I wanted to see, especially in a time where, you know, so much of our conversation sort of devolve into a kind of large fight where opposing sides say incendiary remarks to each other and then quickly go offline. I wanted to see what would happen if we contained people with very, very different opinions in the same space. What would be the common factors and what would be the differences, and could they work differences out?
Well, it strikes me when I was thinking, what could I do this, that we are so often in our own sort of bubbles of comfortable camaraderie, people who know and speak and think about the same kind of things that we speak about. It takes some courage, I think, on the part of your guests to be willing to submit themselves to this.
It takes a great, great deal of courage. And every time we do a sleepover, I am overwhelmed and inspired by the willingness, the bravery to be in that room together. I think, you know, at first when we came up with this notion, you know, it really was a response to the kind of devolution of communication and kind of face-to-face time that I'm seeing happening in our world today. And it's utterly imperative that we do have that time, that we can be together. And I think that notion is so connecting with people. So when I reach out to people and explain what the intention is, many of them feel the same way.
Here's a clip from the second episode. This one was focused on Sachi, who tells us she's a brown woman, she has a brown father, and her problem actually is that he shows his disapproval for her by giving her the silent treatment, refusing to communicate. But what we're going to hear is a part of reaction to something Alan said about, you know, he expected when he got there that other people would look like him, which she calls him out on for being, you know, sort of entitled white man expecting everyone to look like him. Let's hear.
That's, I think, where this debate gets derailed, which is that when people talk like that, people in the majority take it as a criticism and not merely just a statement of what is true, that because you're in the majority, you do get the privilege to walk into a room and expect that there's going to be a lot of people like you. But I'm not saying that you have to hang yourself because you're like a white dude here, but
I didn't say people like me. I mean, maybe I
you
said,
you
but
did.
I didn't mean people like me because I don't relate to the world as being filled with people like me, whatever.
Okay.
That's a clip from The Sleepover, a radio show and podcast that throws three strangers with a problem into a hotel room to help each other out. And our guest is Sukyun Lee, the host and co-producer of The Sleepover. Sukyun, what was going on there?
Yeah, so this was, you know, a conversation that spilled out, and suddenly there was an electricity in the room, a tension, you know, we heard there, you know, there's Alan, you know, he says that he suffers from foot and mouth disease. He's quite aware that Sachi has convictions. She has strong feelings about white male privilege. And there he is, you know, having expressed the assumption that he would walk into a room and see three white guys just like him. And she really wanted to tell him that as a Indo-Canadian woman, she would never be able to assume that kind of thing. And so,
but she doesn't shoot him down, which I think is great. She doesn't say,
yeah,
can't
I mean,
talk
he
like
gets
that.
His back up and he wants to walk away. And what is extraordinary, if you listen to where it goes further in the podcast, seemingly opposing viewpoints come together. What happens is as we get to know one another, despite their seemingly opposing perspectives, Sachi and Alan find incredible similarities. They're both extremely blunt. They speak their minds. They come from very similar families with incredible pressures, very funny individuals. And suddenly we're realizing that they're kind of the same person, but in different bodies. A 25-year-old Indo-Canadian woman and a 65-year-old old dad, Jewish, grumpy guy. In this kind of situation, the differences are explored, and normally, you know, if this was taking place online, it would have spiraled out into this kind of, like, I don't know, big...
insults and name calling. And
yeah,
that kind
and insults, name calling, blocking people. When we're all in a room, you cannot escape. You are there, and we want to see what the extra layer is. Everyone is walking around with convictions and assumptions. And as you say, most of us, even in our friend circle online, you know, we talk to other people that reaffirm our viewpoint. It is so seldom that we walk out of our own comfort zones to see what another person can offer.
Well, there they are in this room together. It's getting messy increasingly. There's wet bathing suits, you know, empty coffee cups, pizza. The boxes. But this could easily veer into that, you know, the kind of reality TV construct of highlighting or even creating tension for tension's sake. So how do you avoid that as a producer?
Yeah, that's a total, you know, that is one intention. I make it very clear that there is no winner or loser in this. There is no competitive aspect to this. This is not just for, you know, entertainment. This is to actually try to facilitate really important conversations that can bring us together. So the whole ethos of the show is that of humanism and that of curiosity and that of playfulness and that of coming together. So it is completely devoid of the kind of, you know, wrestling match, mudslinging, contrived conflicts. I think the fact that there is no competitive aspect of it really helps people, you know, once they understand that this is not this sort of tacky, terrible entertainment situation, they want to be there.
Thank you so much for letting us spy a little bit on the sleepover.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Sookyun Lee is host and co-producer of the Sleepover radio show and podcast, which throws strangers together in a hotel room for 24 hours to see if they can forge meaningful connections. There's a link to the trailer for the show on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you're far from home without friends, life can lose some of its luster. Pair that with having little to no money and freshly graduating from college, and you've got a recipe for some serious desperation. So when Maya Goldberg-Safer was offered a babysitting gig, you'd think she'd have jumped at the opportunity. Then she met Louis. The 7-year-old was a tornado of destruction, but also charisma. This is a story of unexpected friendship and following it wherever it takes you.
The summer I met Louis, I was living alone in an attic, far from home, in the house of my second cousins at least once removed. It was my just got out of college, don't want to go back home move. I had a part-time unpaid internship and no job. My cousins, world-class scientists at the University of Chicago, were always generous and kind, but there could be no stopping it. I felt wildly adrift and bluntly alone.
Ah!
Stop. Ah! Then I met Louis.
What?
The first time I saw him, he hurled down the stairs, tore open the door, and stared at me. "What do you want?" he spit out. What I thought I wanted was a job as his nanny. But as soon as I stepped forward, Louis ran away screaming.
"Get out of here!"
Inside, he was climbing the couches and pawing his mother's face with his feet. She didn't seem to notice. Then Louis scooped their giant black and white cat off the floor like he was getting ready to toss a baby.
"Kitty, kitty, 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 cat."
I left with no intention to return.
"Hi, this is Maya."
But then Louis's mom called. "We know you're thinking about moving out of the neighborhood," she said, "but I just wanted you to know that we really loved you." How could I refuse that? I needed friends anywhere I could find them. Even if one was a child who seemed like he'd spent the last 6 years living alone in the wilderness. But that wasn't really who he was.
"Okay, so you get the kettle, the nice little kettle. You open it, you pour out all the old, disgusting water. You fill it up. Well, not all the way to the top. Just about where you think your cup of tea is gonna be, and you turn it on and you wait. wait, and you just wait. This is so easy.
The key thing about this babysitting gig was that I didn't actually have any work to do. Louie didn't have homework, and the house had no rules.
I search on YouTube.
Mario Tetris.
And find funny videos.
It's like a mixture of Mario and Tetris. It is an epic game.
As long as his parents came home and Louie was still alive, I'd done my job. All I had to do was follow him around. He showed me his apartment, his school, and the neighborhood.
How much more school do you have left?
I have this week and then next week and then off.
Louie loved words like gosh dang it and idiot face, which he hurled at other people as though hacking through brush.
Because these little brats are getting on my nerves, jerks.
But Louie was also 7, and certain things never failed to make him giggle.
Hello.
All dogs, especially ones with whiskers.
Oh, dog,
let's pet it.
Yeah.
And graffiti on stop signs, and being called the devil, which he thought was hilarious. He also loved food. He loved chocolate. He loved the smell of chocolate. He loved bowls of salad, each individual leaf.
I'm about to interview this chicken.
So you're gonna interview the chicken?
I'm gonna interview the chicken rice. Yeah. Oh, this chicken. Woof! That was a ride into heaven. I could admire this all day without stopping. Maya, this is a really special day.
Okay, so we have to do more?
Yeah.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot!
No! Whoever gets to 3 first wins.
In winter, we played rock, paper, scissors and danced wildly to Billy Joel.
Danced around for no reason.
We stomped around the hardwood floors and shook salt around the kitchen.
3, 2, 1, go!
We climbed and wrestled and burped.
Are you gonna splash through the puddle? Do you ever go around puddles?
No. I'm always so curious about everything. Look at you, respect my curiousness.
But Louie also told me he didn't have friends at school. His mom worried about it too. Was he too mean or too weird? Did the other kids just not understand him?
Do you think you're different than other people in your class or the same?
Very different. I'm much more weird and stuff.
What do you think's the weirdest thing about you?
I don't really play a lot.
Although he never said it, I was pretty sure I'd become Louie's best friend.
Maya? My sidekick for right now?
And he'd become mine too.
So she's asking me for, guidance?
Louie had chosen me, not to work for him, but to love. And this made my new job an aberration, a strange kind of grace, a small miracle we had accidentally invented.
It reminds me of how lucky we are to have tea, I mean.
What do you think we should be most grateful for in our lives?
Life. Life. Yeah. Most grateful for life. Would you like to be a hand? Would you, for who you are? Would you like to be an orange that's bound to be picked and eaten? Would you? Would you like to be a big oak tree? Who's bound to be chopped down? Would you like to be a kitty who's on the street? Would you like to be a garbage can full of trash and junk? Would you like to be a booger stuck in someone's nose? Would you like to be smoke who dissolves in the air? Would you like to be an onion? Would you like to be some coffee? Would you like to be a teapot? Would you like to be a pan? Would you like to be a calendar? Would you like to be a dog? Yes. Dogs are awesome. They're furry and cute and they have great noses. Okay, go get me a cup. I need to pour the hot water.
Is it ready?
Yeah. I know it's ready because this turned off. Do you want any sugar in it?
No, thank you.
Milk?
But here's the thing. At the beginning of the year, When Louie's mom called to convince me to work for her family, she told me something else, too. It will be totally temporary, she'd said. Don't worry, we're moving to France in a year. And at the time, I remember looking around my empty attic room, feeling totally relieved.
Maya, talk about how you feel.
I feel...
It's been 7 months since Louie's family left for Paris. I've made other friends and moved into a legit apartment, with Craigslist roommates, of course.
Well, one half of my brain knows that people are always looking for someone that they really get along with and love and who really loves them back, right?
Yeah, definitely.
But, well, I keep listening to his voice. I have him on my recorder, in my iTunes, on my phone, so we hang out all the time, really. But I miss my best friend a lot.
Well, the following question is, will Maya ever get her friend back? Will she ever get her nice friend back?
In his most recent email to me, sent from his family's new apartment in Paris, Louis wrote, "Hi, Maya. Sup?"
You have to find the person in the world. If you got across the world, who cares? You just need that person. If you're in America and the person is in England, you can cross to England or whatever country she's in that you're not in. And
do you think you'll find a person, or have you found them?
It's my cat. I have like two. So they can be like different genders, older than you, younger than you, more narrow-minded than you, less interested in this thing than you. I have like two, my cat and Maya, and yeah. I have two.
I used to watch Louis running free in the park, chasing treasures in the grass, his head waving up and down like a tail. I liked to watch him from the white stone benches, as boundless as the dogs we admired so much. I wondered if he'd always remember me at that time, because that's how I'd always remember him. Louis at 7 years old, flying through the grass, humming wildly, aloud. But never quite for me.
The Sitter Dispatch was produced by Dennis Funk and Maya Goldberg-Safer and first aired on ReSound from the Third Coast International Audio Festival.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hostess Twinkies once topped the snack cake food chain in America and beyond.
Every spaceman knows you just gotta have Hostess Twinkies along. Even space girls know it. You get a big delight in every bite. Delicious Hostess cream-filled Twinkies taste out of this world.
Like that commercial from the 1970s, the golden sponge cake with creamy filling ran past its considerable shelf life. In the early aughts, Hostess announced that it was on the brink of bankruptcy and that Twinkies, Honey Buns, and Ding Dongs were going down with it. That was before a private equity firm took over and launched what it called the sweetest comeback in the history of ever, but not without some heavy costs. Drew Harwell is a staff writer at the Washington Post and wrote what it took to save the Twinkie. We reached him via Skype. And Drew, hello. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So remind us of this Twinkie timeline, its ups and downs. Why and when did Hostess announce they were going to stop making Twinkies?
Yeah, so for a couple decades, they were on top of the world, and then they started to have all these sorts of labor issues where they were fighting with their workers over pensions and labor costs. And so by 2012, they filed bankruptcy for a second time, and it looked like they were going to shut down the manufacturing lines for good, stop making Twinkies and cupcakes and Ding Dongs and sort of all these iconic snacks that we had known and loved. And there was this huge public outcry. And in the following years, these private equity buyer started to see, hey, clearly there's, you know, an interest in sort of saving this iconic brand. And hey, we can actually get it for cheap too, because the company is sort of going under. So they spent a lot of money to buy the company, and now it's sort of back, and they're making the kind of snacks that they've been doing for a long time. But they've also had to, you know, sort of carve into the bottom line and make a lot of big changes to their bakeries and their workforce to sort of get it back into a normal functioning company again.
So who were these private equity companies, and are they still selling them as Hostess?
Yeah, so one of them, his name is C. Dean Metropoulos, and he's a really sort of fascinating guy. He's known as a turnaround artist, and he has become a billionaire over the years and buying up these sort of food brands that, you know, you probably have in your kitchen, but the company is sort of going under for any number of reasons. And he'll buy them, and then he'll do the sort of typical private equity thing where, you know, lots of jobs will be cut, but a lot of money will be spent on sort of upgrading the manufacturing, streamlining stuff, maybe closing some factories, but expanding production so they can make money on one side and sort of save money on the other. So he partnered up with another sort of private equity firm, and now they are still running it. It's called Hostess Brands, and it's chopped off some of the snacks it used to make, but it's still sort of making the big things that a lot of Americans know and love, like Twinkies.
How are Twinkies selling today?
Twinkies are selling a little bit better than they were, you know, a couple years ago, but it's nothing like they were selling back in, you know, the 50s, when it was this really hearty sort of post-war snack that you could throw in your lunchbox or throw in a time capsule like Bill Clinton did in 1999. You know, it was this really sort of American treat. But over the years, you know, there was a greater push toward maybe eating food that is a little seemingly more natural or more healthy or less filled with vanilla cream. And their sales sort of went down. So by 2012, they were not really selling that well. But now that there was a feeling like, hey, maybe we were taking these things for granted, they're starting to sell much better. And the new Hostess under, you know, C. Dean Metropoulos and co. have done a lot of changes to get them on more shelves. One of the things about Twinkies was, for so long, they weren't even on vending machines. They weren't even in convenience stores. This was one of the sort of outdated parts of the old business that people thought maybe cost them a lot of money. So with little changes like that, they've been able to sell in these sort of grab-and-go ways that they never were before, and they're selling a little bit better now.
We're talking about the great Twinkie turnaround with Drew Harwell. He's a staff writer at the Washington Post, and he wrote about the ups and downs of the iconic snack food, which was threatened with extinction but has since been revived and is selling fabulously, pulling in, as you write, $650 million in revenue in 12 months, ending May 31st. No small change, but any changes in the recipe? I mean, I don't remember seeing whole grains in Twinkies. Is it the original?
No. No quinoa, no kale in the Twinkies. It's a little bit different, and they actually spent millions of dollars sort of on these company chemists to go in and do one big thing, which is extend their shelf life. You know, for so long, people had said that Twinkies would sort of last till, you know, the final days alongside cockroaches. And that was never really true. They sort of would last for about 30 days before they started turning into the kind of Twinkie you wouldn't want to eat. But they were able to sort of, through the magic of chemistry, double that shelf life. So now they're able to sell for 65 days. And, you know, there's a consumer sort of convenience to that. But the big thing on the manufacturing side is that they can expand the delivery time, so they don't have to run trucks as often as they need to. They've sort of switched their delivery method from delivering straight to stores to delivering to warehouses that then sort of distribute the product like that. Little tiny tweaks like that can save them a lot of money on one side while still sort of selling the same kind of product. Some people say it tastes a little bit different, but to my palate, which is pretty unrefined, I don't really taste a difference.
Well, this is all good news for Twinkie, and those refinements sound good, but this isn't exactly a job creation story, is it?
No, it's really not. And, you know, Twinkie and Hostess sort of created this distribution method that relied on these regional bakeries that were all over the country. You'll sort of see them in some small towns where they look like thrift stores almost, and they sell old sort of baked goods for discount prices. That was a good method, but it also cost a lot of money. It was fairly inefficient because they had to staff all these regional bakeries. They had to stock them, and then they were selling them at low prices, so they weren't making as much money on the outside. So with the private equity buyers, and they've cut down on a lot of those discount stores. The big thing is that they've closed down most of the bakeries. Even the bakery in the Chicago suburb of Schiller Park, where the Twinkie was first baked, has been shut down. And 400 of those jobs were affected. Either people were laid off or moved to other bakeries. So, you know, it was hard for people to see that this company was, you know, reinvented and resurrected. And yet a lot of the production lines and industrial ovens and people who had been working making these things for decades, they were no longer needed. There's now only a few bakeries in Indiana and Kansas and Georgia that do most of the baking. But, you know, thousands of jobs have been cut over the last several years, and a lot of these were sort of union represented manufacturing jobs that had been with Hostess for their entire career. So, you know, a couple of years ago there were 22,000 workers in more than 40 bakeries. Now it's down to about 1,000 workers and 3 bakeries. So it's an incredible sort of shaving down. And, you know, the company will say, we had to get to that point to be more efficient, and we're making a product and we're selling well, so we're getting closer to being profitable. But, you know, for the people who have seen this company as an American icon for 100 years or so, that's sort of a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah, and it's still an iconic brand, however, that's selling very well. So what's next? Do we see varieties of Twinkies?
Yeah, what's next is they're going to start doing these weird kind of exclusive lines. They're doing a frozen deep fried Twinkie that they're selling exclusively at Walmart, which is probably not a surprise. They did a year long sort of partnership with Walmart, it seems, pinned to the state fair kind of crowd. They're also doing these sort of movie tie-ins. They're doing like a key lime slime Twinkie pinned to the Ghostbusters movie that's out this week. So there are all these sort of ideas that they're investing money in to think, how can we sort of ride this kind of pop culture wave that we've been on for a couple of years? And how can we get these people who may be eating healthy in every other meal but still want this sort of calorie-rich indulgence?
That lasts for 65 days.
Right. 65-day indulgence.
Drew, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Drew Harwell, he's staff writer at the Washington Post, and we spoke with him about his article, What It Took to Save a Twinkie. Now, you can find a link to that article and a Twinkie time lapse. Now, we cannot verify exactly the source of this, but it's a Twinkie and a tomato aging over several weeks. Find a link to look at both at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
I was thinking along the lines of no TV and no beer, make Homer something, something.
Go crazy?
Don't mind if I do!
Homer and Marge Simpson, they are hearkening back to the heyday of the couch potato. Today's TV viewers are no longer glued to their couches, leading Lawrence Scott to wonder if the vegetative viewer exists anymore. He's a writer and academic who's teaching at Arcadia University in London and wrote about the extinction of the couch potato for The New Yorker. We reached him via Skype. Lawrence, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So your students, college age, didn't know what a couch potato is. For the benefit of young listeners, what is it, and where did this phrase come from?
So a couch potato, the phrase was coined in the late 70s. A man called Tom Iacino phoned up his friend, and his girlfriend picked up, and Tom said to the girlfriend, oh, is the couch potato there? He claims to have sort of invented it spontaneously, referring to someone, and we've taken this on to mean someone who just loves slouching on the couch for hours on end, usually eating sort of ruffled potato chips, I imagine, and just watching hours and hours of television.
Sinking into the ground.
Yeah, just reaching comatose levels of TV consumption. That was sort of the vibe of it in the 90s anyway.
So I'll ask the question in the title of your article, what happened to the couch potato?
Well, that's what the strangest thing. You mentioned young listeners. I was taking some university students on a tour, and we were thinking about new words and obsolete words. And I tried to explain to them what a couch potato was, because one of them didn't know what it meant at all. And I thought, well, what's going on? And my book, The Four-Dimensional Human, which is out next month, it talks a lot about how digital technologies are impacting just the basic ways we live our lives. And so I'm always on the lookout for the ways in which language is changing and our expressions are changing. It also sort of hints at changes to our moral outlook. And I think with where has the couch potato gone, it has to do with this sense that we're no longer really ashamed of our lives in front of screens. There was a sense that the screen was sort of bad for you in some way. When I was young in the 80s, we were told not to sit too close to the television. Now I take my laptop into bed with me and sit sort of cuddling it. I'm about a foot away from the screen and it's in the bed. I think there's something about the way digital devices have reprogrammed our whole relationship to watching television.
Yeah, people can watch anywhere. So with their natural habitat of couch gone, are couch potatoes now screen junkies?
Yeah, I mean, what's a better word? I think we've moved from sort of the couch potato term was always pretty much pejorative. It was also almost, it was something people were guilty about admitting that they were. It was a sense of lethargy and almost a depressive, passive way to live your life when you're being a couch potato. And I think now people are still concerned and young parents are still concerned with how children are using digital devices and screens, but it's moved from a depressive mode almost to a manic mode, isn't it? It's about how do we calm people down from trying to do a million different things at once? Because let's remember that now the television has gone onto a laptop. It's sort of hidden there among many other potentially more diligent pastimes, or you know, you could be doing anything on your laptop, but you could also just be watching the latest episode of Transparent or something.
Well, you're right. There is a sense that it is more active. You're doing something when you have your laptop and you're looking back and forth with your phone. You know, it's not as sluggish as the kind of moral judgment of couch potato. But does watching TV, being glued to the screen far from the family room, actually take away that judgment?
I think there's a lot less sort of embarrassment than there used to be. I think even the generation before me, they would never sort of admit to watching television during the day. Sort of daytime TV was seen as sort of a slightly embarrassing activity. And now when I'm around London on the tubes and stuff, the metro, I can see people watching television. I can see last night's soap opera and it's sort of piping up through their earbuds. And I thought, wow, I mean, I'm not really into sort of these judgment calls of you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that. I'm just observing a sort of a moral change that's really fascinating. And also, when we think about live television and what we call legacy television, traditional television is so much really in decline. And I think a lot of these TV shows are trying to get viewer involvement via the internet as a way of saving it as a format. You know, you always see the idea of celebrities live tweeting during their shows.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do that, viewer numbers really spike. We're always being told now to get involved, the hashtag, you know, linked to the program. So it's all about involvement. And, you know, the old couch potato is sort of half asleep.
But how about binge watching? I mean, people do stay holed up in their houses for an entire weekend to catch up on a series. That sounds like old school couch potato behavior.
It's totally old school. And I was thinking maybe when you're asking before what has replaced it, I think the closest replacement from couch potato is the idea of Netflix binging or any sort of binge watching in that way. But the point I made in the New Yorker article, I think, was that that's sort of the couch potato is this big lump and noun, immobile, just lying there. And binging, even that suggests some of the jitteriness and the hyperactivity of digital life now, the sense that we're just consuming so much that it's almost not that good for us. So as I said, there's still these sort of concerns about it. It's just the mode has totally shifted and the potato metaphor no longer makes any sense in these sort of multitasking, slightly hyper times that digital technologies are sort of encouraging in us all the time.
Mm. And it does allow people to leave their home and look at their screens in public spaces. So how about it, Lawrence? Have you played with any new terms for the morphed or the updated couch potato?
What would it be? It would be like, a sort of a screen hummingbird, or you'd need something really sort of hyperactive. I don't know, something that like the laptop leopard or something. I don't know.
Well, we'll keep working on that one.
Yeah, please do. If listeners have any suggestions, I'd love to hear them.
Well, Lawrence, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Lawrence Scott is a contributing writer for The New Yorker, teaches English and creative writing at Arcadia University in London. His book, The Four-Dimensional Human, is coming out in August. There's more on him and the article at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, Lawrence Scott may think that the end of the couch potato era is upon us, but he's in England, where they don't watch the elaborate television productions we call political conventions. We have an apolitical question, whether or not you plan to plant yourself on the couch this week. What do you call the thing to change the channel? Is it a clicker or a remote? Or maybe you lost it and you can't even remember. Well, it's not exactly Decision 2016, but maybe something we can agree to disagree on. Team Clicker, Team Remote. Let us know. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio or on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back on Monday with a conversation with Judy Blume, which she told us will be her last book tour interview ever, so don't miss it. That's Monday at 2 on NHPR or on your own time with the Word of Mouth podcast or at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. From all of us at Word of Mouth, enjoy your beautiful summer weekend.